It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid? Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back. Send them back. Send them back.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to The U.S. Economy with Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman. The great Joseph Stiglitz, author of The Price of Inequality, and the equally great Paul Krugman, author of End This Depression Now, talk about the problems facing the U.S. economy.
Then there's the issue of trade and income inequality. And used to be that we traded mostly with countries, at least manufacturing, because we traded with countries that were at similar level of economic development. And that presumably had relatively little effect on income distribution. If you make, if the U.S. sends auto parts to Canada and Canada sends assembled cars back to the United States, that's not going to be making a big difference that's just increased efficiency. Now we do a lot of our trade with countries that are substantially lower income and are selling us labor-intensive products. That's probably increasing inequality through skill differentials. The highly educated tend to do better, although most of our increased inequality is not simply highly educated versus less educated, but part of it is, and that's an increasing factor. So I had an interesting evolution myself. I was writing papers 18 years ago, 17 years ago, saying that trade isn't that big a factor in inequality because the numbers are just not big enough, which was true 17 years ago. But Canada, China and Mexico are a much bigger factor in our trade now than they were then. And so that is some. Now the question is, what do you do about it? And there are a lot of reasons not to want to have protectionism, certainly not to have a general return to a protectionist world. If nothing else, because we're supposed to be global citizens at least a little bit. And for the very poorest countries, having access to open world markets is critical. Bangladesh almost literally keeps its head above water only because it can export labor-intensive products. The right way to deal with it is to have a decent society with a strong social safety net. So
it's more than a safety net. I mean, training programs,
right, everything,
and give people skills. I mean, the standard theory is that with open markets, the winners, the country as a whole, could be better off. The winners could compensate the losers, but they never do. And that's really the problem. That in fact, some of the advocates of globalization, at the same time that they're talking about the wonders of globalization, have been saying to compete, you have to strip away the social safety net. And in that sense, they're doubly hurting the people in the middle and the bottom.
Yeah, it's worth actually. Germany is an interesting case. Now, Germany is doing relatively well in this crisis. Not, I think, as well as they think they are, but they're doing relatively well. If the euro breaks up, then they'll discover that they have some problems. But what's been really amazing is to watch conservatives in this country adopt Germany as an icon. They say, well, they've got austerity, which they really don't. But if you actually look, why is Germany able to export so well? They pay very high wages, even by our standards. They have a very extensive welfare state to a level that's beyond the wildest dreams of American progressives. Well, what they have is, among other things, very good technical education, very close collaboration between the educational system and industry, strong role of government, a system of corporate governance that is much more like what we used to have in this country. Actually, labor is represented on the boards of companies, all of which suggests that if you really want to be able to be a high-wage country competing in the global economy, you actually want to move in the opposite direction from what people who say that we must slash social programs. You actually want a more integrated, more cohesive society.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, the Scandinavian countries have done much better in this crisis and have grown faster and have been more stable.
If you look at Sweden, look at what they do, and you just described it in the abstract without saying it had anything to do with a particular country, and put that in front of what is the conventional wisdom about how economics works here, we would say there must be grass growing in the streets. They can't possibly survive as an economy. And actually, I sometimes still run across people, less so in the last couple of years, but who are just sure that there must be terrible, terrible economic situation there. I say, have you ever visited Stockholm? Have you ever walked around? This does not look like a desperate place. This actually looks like they're doing pretty well.
But can I come back to the issue of inequality and globalization and talk about Germany? Because I think that they've done a lot of the things in the right direction, but they haven't really kept up with the Scandinavian countries. And the result of that is that while, 30 years ago, they were in the middle of the advanced industrial countries in terms of inequality.
Germany.
They were one of the better countries. They were not as good as Scandinavia, but they were.
Right.
They've now moved into the middle. Mm. And the point of this is that, to a large extent, inequality is the result of what we do. It's not just market forces. Market forces are at play in Scandinavia, in Germany, in the UK. And we shape those market forces. And the way we've shaped those market forces has resulted in the most inequality of any of the advanced industrial countries and the least equality of opportunity, very contrary to our image of ourselves. It's not American dream. It's really a myth. And what you've also seen over time is how countries that, interestingly, have imitated the United States have done like the United States. The UK used to be in the middle of the league table, and now it's second to the United States in terms of inequality. Whereas Scandinavia's kept up, struggled, and inequality has increased a little bit. But it is still the most equality of opportunity and the least inequality.
Yeah, I think this comes down to there's this fatalism that, it's a global economy, there's nothing you can do, it's going to be extremes, you just cannot have the kind of relatively equal society and social justice that maybe was possible back when the rest of the world was in ruins. I get that all the time. But just look at it and you say, there are countries that the Scandinavians managed to maintain a high level of widespread distribution of the benefits of economic growth and high productivity. You do not have to be the way we are. I mean, even Canada is a much less harsh, unequal society than ours. And they're pretty much obviously operating in pretty much the same environment we are. For the most part, they even speak the same language. And it's showing that these are choices. So as you're saying, it's choices both about how we run markets, because the distribution of market income is not something that's God-given. There's a lot you can do to influence that. And it's a choice about what you do afterwards as well, and whether you provide universal health coverage, whether you provide decent support, whether you provide an educational system that is well funded for everybody, not just for people who have to live in the right neighborhoods.
Yeah, and also the tax system is obviously important. And all of these are important not only for the issue of inequality and opportunity, but also for efficiency and growth. So, for instance, if you have a tax system like ours where speculators are taxed at a fraction of the rate of people who work for a living, or if you can keep your money in a bank account in the Cayman Islands rather than in the United States, you have incentives. You know, those rules not only give lower tax rates to those who can avail themselves of these, but it distorts the economy. You wind up with more speculation, more instability, and the money isn't in the Cayman Islands because it grows better in the sunshine there. In fact, it's the lack of sunshine that is the reason that people keep their money there.
I just had a conversation with someone from the financial industry who was trying to make the defense about things like carried interest, that especially, you know, which isn't even investment income, but it gets taxed still as if it was, and it's 15%. And, well, you know, but there's a lot of effort put in, and with uncertain return, and so you need to. And my I couldn't help. You know what else involves a lot of effort with uncertain return? Writing books. And somehow I don't get that tax break. You don't get that tax break. But there we are.
Yeah, just to clarify that this question of carried interest, when a fund, private equity or hedge fund, earns money from their customers, they earn a fee. That is their income. They're allowed to defer that. When I used to work in hedge fund industry, you could defer that, keep it invested in your business, and at the end, on any gain, you paid capital gains, but on the original fee income, you paid income tax.
Right.
Now, they've transformed that income into a capital gain,
right,
which it is not. It is income. This is legalized fraud, essentially.
Yeah. A lot of that in our system.
Confessions of a former hedge fund manager. Healthcare. You talked, the phrase you used was how we manage our markets. Now, I remember thinking one of the most profound papers I read, I'm the son of a doctor, was Ken Arrow's paper in the early 1960s on why healthcare is different. Why doesn't free market recipe work for a healthcare system? And what other designs do we have to do to take care of that?
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So what Arrow did, said we have a picture, we have this wonderful idealized version of a market that's in all of our textbooks, in which a market is a perfectly efficient way to organize activity. And not necessarily fair, which is a different question, but at least it's efficient. And there are a bunch of things that you need, that there are a bunch of assumptions that are involved. There are assumptions that everybody has the same information. There's an assumption that everybody knows what they're doing, that the buyers understand what the sellers are providing, that you are able to make informed decisions. And what Ken Arrow did, great economist Kenneth Arrow, in more than, I guess, almost 60 years ago now, he said, look, if you made a list of these things and thought about the various ways in which markets can fail, in which this paradigm doesn't apply, every one of those things applies to healthcare. Healthcare is the absolute nightmare for the proposition that markets are a good way to organize things. That you have asymmetric information of various kinds. People may have a better notion of first of all, you have to rely on insurance. You cannot have a healthcare because the big costs are unpredictable and huge if they occur. Very few people can afford to pay for it out of pocket. So already you're having to rely on third-party payers, which is going to be a big problem for any kind of efficiency. You have a situation where when applying for insurance, people may know more about their health condition than the insurers do. On the other hand, in dealing with healthcare issues itself, those are highly technical. You're not going to be able to know whether your doctor is recommending the right thing. So there are a whole set of...
I mean, you're a patient, not a consumer.
You're a patient, that's right. Yeah. This notion that we actually talk about healthcare consumers, then that has become standard language, and it's deeply disturbing, right? I am not consuming healthcare, I'm receiving it, I'm a patient. And of course, then the notion that we're, you know, you even see people talking about, well, people need to be able to do comparative shopping. And right, you've just been rushed into the emergency room with a heart attack, and they say, no, I think they have a better deal at the hospital down the... And And Arrow actually said that he pointed out that a lot of the things we do in healthcare, or we did in healthcare 60 years ago, were obviously responses to this. We expect an ethical standard from doctors that you don't expect from used car salesmen, because a used car salesman who misleads you is not going to kill you. And so you have a lot of, and what was happened is, okay, so healthcare happens to be just on general principles, an area where free market principles do not apply.
Can I just add one thing? I mean, what's so remarkable about Ken Arrow was that for 200 years, or 175 years before he had written, there was this very influential idea of Adam Smith that the market, markets would lead, pursuit of self-interest would lead, as if by an invisible hand, to the efficiency of the economy. And Ken Arrow was the person who actually proved the circumstances under which it was correct. So if anybody who talks about the wonders of the free market, he was the one who actually showed that Adam Smith was right. But in showing he was right, he also understood that it was only right under very restricted conditions. And the healthcare sector was one condition in which it was never right. And, some of my own work on economics of asymmetric and information.
Just mention that. That's the core understanding. This is Joe's work.
What it showed is the reason the invisible hand seems invisible is that it's not there. And this sector is a real case at point.
And just to add, then, this is all abstract reasoning, but then you look at reality, and it's overwhelming. The looking across countries, the United States has the most market-oriented healthcare system, and also by far the most expensive, without getting better results.
Poor results.
We're ranked 37th in the world by the World Health Organization in terms of quality.
Right, and within the United States, although Medicare is very expensive, it's actually been much more successful at cost control than private insurers have been. Medicaid even more successful, and the great thing about America is we're so big and diverse that we actually have everything, all possible systems exist in some version here. The Veterans Health Administration, which is true socialized medicine, actually the government, the doctors are government employees, is incredibly efficient relative to the rest of our healthcare system.
Now, Rob, you did a calculation and you showed that if we had a healthcare system that was as efficient as the best in Europe,
or France, Canada, Germany, or the UK, take your pick,
we would have no deficit.
Yeah, given the baby boom demographics.
That's right. Everyone else, not everyone, but these systems, which vary, right? Canada is just a single payer system, but not socialized medicine. It's actually even called Medicare, but it's Medicare for everybody. France is complicated. It's very Gallic, but it's a mixture of public provision, public health insurance, but it's a much heavier hand of government than the Canadian system. It's about the same cost as the Canadian system, but spectacularly good outcomes relative to anybody's. And Britain has a system which is pure socialized medicine, and the outcomes are a little better than ours, and the cost is 40% of ours. Mm-hmm. So sure, all of these things, and of course, if we were able to emulate these things, we would be able to, our budget problems would be gone.
And also our competitiveness of firms based in the United States might be enhanced.
And it just, of course, defies, so what is the, one of our two presidential tickets, the signature proposal, is to take one of the parts of our system that works pretty well and privatize it.
Repeal what he did as a governor.
Well, Romney, let's make sure that nobody else gets to do what I did as governor of Massachusetts, but then Bill Ryan wanting to essentially privatize Medicare, privatize and underfund it, so dismantle Medicare, which is incredible. It's a rejection of both theory and evidence. That's pretty impressive.
When you look at this interface between medical costs and the budget, this idea that we have to have all these commissions like Bull Simpson and all of these rituals about shares between spending and so forth, why don't we just have a healthcare cost commission? Why don't we look that in the eye?
Because that would be death panels.
True. I also think we have to, the reality of American politics is the drug industries are very influential. The insurance industry is very influential. Sancho, and it has beaten back reforms over and over again. I mean, you take one provision in the one line almost in the Medicare drug bill, the bill that provided prescription drugs for Medicare, and it said that we, the government, the largest purchaser of drugs in the world, couldn't bargain with the drug companies that estimated to be a gift to the drug companies over 10 years of $500 billion. Now, you know, anybody serious about dealing with our deficit, that's a good place to begin. But hardly talked about.
And by the way, it creates an interesting problem for, if you're an economist or just an advocate, how much imperfection are you willing to accept? How much falling short? And, there was a little bit of a dilemma. A lot of us really think that healthcare reform should take the form of single payer. The Medicare for all is where we should go. But that wasn't on the table. So the question is, so we had this plan for originally Jacob Hacker's plan, which became the part of the genesis of Obamacare eventually, which was to have something which was actually run through the markets. It's a Rube Goldberg device that manages to try and get at the effects of a single-payer system without the actual single-payer, but should have a public option in there. So it's not entirely the playing field of the insurance companies. Then the public option gets killed in the political scrim. Do you still support it? And in the end, my judgment was, yes, you do, because the important thing right now is for us is to establish the principle of universal health care. And once that's in place, then there'll be a lot of pressure to make it more efficient, to make it work better. Eventually, we'll manage to squeeze the insurance companies out of their controlling role, but first get it in place. And that's, of course, that more than anything else is what's at stake in this election.
So some people would say that we had, 47 million people uninsured,
right,
who came onto the scrolls with the health care passage.
That's right.
That's transformed into a budget problem because they're paying monopoly prices for the various services.
It turns out not to be a big deal. The amazing thing is the uninsured in America are by and large young adults, mm-hmm, which were not expensive. Mm-hmm. The expensive people are the elderly who are covered under Medicare.
And the other aspect of that is that America is not so inhumane that at the end, when they need, desperate, they do get into a hospital, but because it's been delayed, the costs are larger, and then it gets shifted in the complicated accounting that they have to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, one of the reasons why we have such an inefficient healthcare system is that we don't provide access to large fractions of our population.
Yeah, and the amazing thing when all is said and done is that getting to a sort of universal healthcare system, despite the absence of a public option, despite the compromises made, is really not a big budget buster. They were able to pay for it with relatively modest cost-saving measures in Medicare and a little bit of extra taxation. And on balance, Congressional Budget Office says that the health reform bill is actually going to reduce the budget deficit, not increase it, and it's not going to lead to huge burdens on the public. So now it may die. That's really very much at stake in 2 weeks. If Obama's reelected, this thing survives. America finally joins the community of civilized nations that provide some form of health insurance to all their citizens. If he loses, then it gets killed.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth commenting the sense in which we are out of tune with the rest of the advanced industrial countries. Sarkozy, who was on the right in France, came to Colombia and gave a talk. And at the time that Obama, the health care bill was under discussion, and one of the students asked him to comment on this debate. And he said, "Well, I don't want to meddle in your affairs, but..." And then he said, "I don't understand it. In France, we take it as a basic right, a human right, that you should have access to health care, no matter, what your income level is." So for us, we just don't, and this is a question of the right and the left. Basic human rights, and he just couldn't understand
the Olympic ceremonies in Britain with the dancing nurses, where people here said, "What is that about?" But of course, the British love their health system. We think that it's if you've listened to people here, it's a hellhole and disaster. Actually, if you've ever been treated in it, it's not. But it's and by the way, the thing about the politics of it is, if we get it, almost immediately it will become irreversible. It will be, people will say, "How find it inconceivable that we would
I mean,
stop
it,
to
it's like Medicare.
Coverage.
It's like Medicare that most Americans really think is a good system. In fact, the joke in the debate about the Obamacare was a person who said, I want you to keep the government's hands off of
That's
Medicare.
That's not a joke. It really happened.
And
there were quite a few people who were saying, don't let the government get its hands on Medicare.
Yeah. And that actually, I think, raises a fundamental issue that we've been circling around, which is, what is the role of government in our society, in our economy? And the for 30 years now, Americans have been sold a bill of goods that government can't do anything well.
It's the problem, not the solution.
And therefore, if Medicare is successful, it can't be a government program.
Right.
And the same thing in terms of Social Security. They find it very difficult to believe that the transaction costs associated with Social Security are a fraction of that of any private insurance companies providing annuities, and it provides the kinds of insurance against inflation, against other things that you can't get in a private insurance, private annuity. So, that really raises, I think, deeper issues that have been at the center of this campaign.
There was a study done in Oslo a couple of years ago. A number of people participated in that study, Germany, the UK, the United States, and Sweden. And they asked a battery of questions. And not surprisingly, the United States respondents distrusted government more than any of the other countries. And the one question that stood out is, do I trust our government to protect me from powerful interests? And the American answer, no, was off the scales. It was 10 or 15 points more distrust.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.